Just a quick message before the episode gets underway. The Aurora Renewables Summit London is returning on the afternoon of Wednesday, the 26th of June. Book your ticket now to hear from leading experts in the energy industry as they assess the opportunities and challenges within the UK and the wider European renewable sector. You will also benefit from unparalleled networking opportunities. We look forward to seeing you there.
Welcome to Energy Unplugged, the go-to podcast focusing on the global energy transition. My name is Richard Howard, and I'm Aurora's Global Research Director. In this episode, we're going to look at renewables deployment in the UK, considering the scale of the ambition and the challenges that would need to be overcome to realise this. At the moment in the UK, the government is targeting 50 gigawatts of offshore wind deployed by 2030, far more than double we have installed now. And around 70 gigawatts of solar deployed by 2035, all working towards a vision to achieve net zero power by 2035. The Labour Party has lifted its ambition even higher, targeting 60 gigawatts of offshore wind by 2030 and 100% clean power by the same date. And the reality for any of these sorts of targets is that there are significant barriers standing in the way of achieving anywhere near this pace of deployment. For example, the availability of grid and grid curtailment issues, the cost and availability of supply chain key components, the cost of finance, which has increased significantly with the general change in monetary environment, and even permitting and planning and the pipeline of projects. These are just a few of the issues that developers and investors flag in the many conversations that we have at Aurora. So in this podcast, I'd like to understand how companies are navigating these challenges and what policymakers could do to unlock investment into renewables in the UK. I'm joined by Keith Anderson, who's the CEO for Scottish Power, and where he's been since 2012. Keith has full responsibility for the company's activities in the UK, including a plan to invest £10 billion into the sector by 2025. Strengthening the position of the company as a utility of the future. Beyond his activities at Scottish Power, Keith has been a member of the Number 10 Business Council, the UK government's investment trade advisory group, and was even a business leader at COP26. Welcome to the podcast, Keith.
Good to see you again.
Yeah, good to see you, Keith. And indeed, this podcast is a follow-up to a panel discussion that me and Keith had on these very same issues at the Aurora Spring Forum just a few weeks ago. But great to have you back and to dive into it again. And where I wanted to kick us off, Keith, kind of what I see is probably the single biggest issue in the UK at the moment, and probably what would hold us back from reaching some of those ambitious targets is grid issues. And it's what many people are talking about and many people flag as kind of the biggest barrier at the moment. And you as a company at Scottish Power have got, I don't know, skin in the game in this actually different dimensions as the grid operator and also as the renewables developer and generator. So maybe first, I mean, be interested in your take generally on the grid issues, but maybe if we start sort of from your perspective as a grid operator, like, what do you see as the barriers to the delivery of grid upgrading of our grid system in the UK?
All right. No, absolutely. It's a good question. I suppose before I answer that directly, what I would maybe, it's just answering another question, which is why does it matter? Why does the grid matter so much? And I think it's just important to remember that, the UK's done really well on decarbonisation. We've done really well on the deployment of renewables. Okay. But where we're not doing as well, you could argue, is the electrification of the economy. Okay, and what we need, we're building wind farms, which is good, we're replacing old coal plant, which is good, but what we're not being good at is electrifying the rest of the economy. So progress on electrifying transport, electrifying heat, electrifying industrial process has been slower. Okay, why? And that's what comes back to the grid. And I think, part of the reason we're now hearing everybody talk about the grid and everybody look at the challenges of the grid is because The other important thing about electrification is it's a massive driver of economic value and the future economy for the UK. And at the same time, what you've been seeing is organizations looking at investing in the UK, whether it's data centers, gigafactories, etc., kind of queuing up the door of the government going, "I would love to come and invest, but somebody's told me I can't get a grid connection for 10 years." Okay, so it's got everybody focused on it. The Chancellor has become phenomenally engaged in the conversation, as has the Prime Minister, as well as the whole of the industry. What's my view of it? I think on the positive side, we have a regulator who probably a couple of years ago really started to switch on to the fact we needed a massive increase in the investment levels in the grid system. And we've seen them run a whole number of processes with the system operator, with the transmission companies, looking at the holistic network design, looking at the future design of the network system. And we're seeing the levels of investment the regulator's allowing to come through in distribution and transmission increase, which is good, okay, because it's incredibly important. You've now seen the plans being issued for, the 50 to 60 billion pound wave of investment that's needed in transmission over the coming years to deliver a grid system that will allow us to do what we need to do by 2040 and then out to the future. So those are the good positive things. People are switched on to it. Where the challenge remains is speed. Okay. And we are not very fast at building big infrastructure in the UK. And this isn't, it's probably not an issue that just affects the energy sector. It probably affects a number of sectors in the UK. It tends to take us a long time to get things through the planning system and to get spades in the ground and to get things built. And that's been a big focus of people's attention, which is how do we go faster and how do we move faster? Because we've got investors lining up to invest in offshore wind, onshore wind, solar. We have people wanting to invest in the rollout of EVs, et cetera. But we're slowing everything down because we can't get the grid built fast enough. Again, I suppose on a positive for a minute, the government engaged Nick Windsor. We've had the Windsor report. The Windsor report's looked at how do you cut the time, which is good. The government has said they're adopting it. The conundrum we have right now is we're probably in the run-up to a general election over the coming months. This is a topic that is in danger of being put to one side while we run an election, and then we'll form a new government, whether it's the same color or a different color than the existing one, and then they'll pick it up again. But that just delays the process even further. We really, really need to inject speed and pace to get the grid built.
I mean, it seems like, if I can characterize, in the 2010s, we were ramping up the deployment of renewables pretty fast. Lots of offshore wind sites being added, lots of solar being added. At that stage, the regulator, I don't know, it was a period in which network companies were actually making fairly healthy returns. But towards the end of that period and coming into the next sort of regulatory price control, I got the sense that the regulator was sort of tried to clamp down a little bit on the network companies and sort of squeeze margins and squeeze returns at precisely the time when in hindsight, hindsight's a wonderful thing. But in hindsight, that's actually when we probably needed to have been doubling down and spending even more investing in grids, because we're now putting even more renewable projects onto the system even faster. And it's taken almost, I don't know, a crises to emerge. We're spending more than £2 billion a year turning off renewables that are built because they haven't got enough grid. We've got grid connection queues in the hundreds of gigawatts of projects wanting to get onto the system.
I think the truth is the whole, not just in our sector, but probably the whole of the UK was going through a phase of looking at regulated, monopolies and across a number of sectors and going, right, look, we need to make sure we're driving value for money. We don't, we need to clamp down on costs, et cetera, et cetera. without a real eye to the future as to God Almighty, we're going to need to completely redesign the whole of the network and shift it rapidly. Yeah, with hindsight, if we'd started 10 years ago, we'd be in a better place, but we didn't. So we are what we are now. The challenge now then is, okay, how aggressive and ambitious are you willing to be in rolling out the grid and doing all of that? Now, there are great plans out there. There are maps out there with lots of lines drawn on them and what we need to do and why we need to do it. But what you still don't have are spades in the ground. And the other reason for the criticality of this now is we are not the only country trying to do this. So you see lots of other European countries out looking at massive wave of investment in their grid, looking at buying up supply chain, looking at securing cable contracts, transformers. This is a huge, big surge in global demand. So, on the one hand, in parts of the supply chain, you see prices being driven by the cost of commodities, etc. Right now, the biggest challenge on securing equipment for transmission and distribution is just physical availability of capacity. And so we really need to again push hard on that and look at as well how do we bring more capacity into that supply chain? And the preference being have some of that capacity located in the UK, but it becomes incredibly important. And then there's and I'm sure you want to talk about this as well, there's the other side of the conundrum, which is how do you best use the capacity you have, i.e. the grid queue? So who do you allow into the grid? What timeline do you allow them in? And in what order do you allow them in? And that has also become a massive topic. And a huge big debate in the conversation because there are more projects in the queue than we need. Are they the correct projects? No. Are they in the right place? All of them? No. Are they in the correct order? No. But again, it's difficult. To sort that quickly, but we need to have a huge focus on it to reorder that queue, clear some stuff out of the queue, and reprioritize what's in the queue. I mean, it is interesting on the one hand, as a country, we've been bold enough to set ourselves a huge, big, ambitious offshore wind target. I've yet to see anybody set as an onshore wind target. I've not seen anybody set as a solar target. And I've not seen anybody set as a battery target and a storage target. Why is that? And I don't know the answer. I don't know why we haven't got that.
There's definitely no grid target, is there? Which is exactly the thing we need to complement the rest.
I'm not advocating going back to central planning and the Central Electricity Board. But if you look at it from the point of view, if you want to start having a conversation about changing the queue and you want to have a conversation up about speeding the grid, surely you kind of have to have an idea as to what do you want on the grid. And therefore that gets you down that route of, and I'm not saying you need to set specific numbers, but why, for example, if we can say we want, and depending who is that picks the number, 40, 50, 60 gigawatts of offshore wind, why can't we say we want another X gigawatts of onshore wind, we want X gigawatts of solar, and we want X of batteries or of storage? And why can't you move to a system where you could then, whether this is done through the ESO or through the government, who knows, but you then basically say, so, okay, not dissimilar to the way you want an extension of what you do with the CFD auction. So when we run CFD auctions, we're in effect saying, here's how many offshore wind farms we want in this next X period onshore solar. Why don't you go out and say, okay, so between now and 2030, we want X gigawatts of offshore wind coming through, X of onshore, X of solar, X of batteries. And send those signals to the market and to investors. Here's the reality of what we want and need. Everybody talks about or gets very upset about what get described as zombie projects in the queue or all these battery projects in the queue. Well, why not send a signal to the market? Here's how many batteries we think we need to balance the system between now and 2030.
Yeah.
And I will guarantee you one thing, it's a hell of a lot less than the number that's sitting in the
Indeed.
queue. But if you do that, I'm not saying they all disappear, but you start sending a signal to investors and to developers. Here's the reality of what we are willing to pay for to secure our grid system.
Yeah.
Therefore, understand if you're in a section of the queue that's 100 times oversupplied, here's the reality of your project. Be aware of it.
The current government has targets for certain things. They've been loath to set a battery target, despite the fact that there's a battery and flexibility strategy. But Labour's in a sense more bold in if there are numbers written down for onshore, for solar, even for hydrogen CCGTs and all sorts of things. I'm not sure I believe that the numbers are deliverable in the timescales that the Labour Party has announced, and Aurora's kind of on the record in saying that.
But I think you can then go and look, and that's fine. And you get into arguments about politics and setting targets. I mean, to me, targets have two or three different purposes in life. You know, and people go, "Oh, you know, the 50-gigawatt target, is that realistic? Can you achieve it by that day?" And I honestly, I don't really get too upset or bothered about it to one extent. You know, and politicians will come along and then talk about it and shift the goalposts and move things. It's fine, the targets are all big enough and ambitious enough that it doesn't particularly put you off your or change your mind about the future growth potential of the market as an investor. Okay. But what you can then do is sitting underneath that, and whether this becomes the role of a system operator or the role of the Department of of DESNZ, is to say, okay, so in the next round of auctions, here's how many gigawatts we want coming through the system, and we'll set the parameters to deliver it. And the system operator could put signals out for the next 5 years. Here's the ancillary services and other services we require from batteries, and it requires X. And so you start to set more detailed parameters in closer time frames. You don't need to adjust your high-level political 50, 60 gigawatt number, but in the near term of, okay, over the next 5 years, we want X. Over the period to 2030, we want Y. And I think the more granular you start to make that, the clearer the signals are. But you're doing it in a way where you still have the big ambition, therefore you still generate and create the investment appetite and and the drive to be involved in the market.
I'm going to switch into a different topic, and then I'm sure you have views on this, Keith, which is that of locational pricing. So you talked about, you know, we have a humongous queue of projects in the hundreds of gigawatts, far beyond what we need. And you're saying we may not have the right projects and they may not be in the right place. We've been having a conversation in the UK for some years now about potentially introducing locational pricing through the REMA market reform process, for anyone who's not been watching it. And most recently, the government says they've ditched the idea of fully nodal pricing in GB, but the idea of zonal pricing is still on the table. And as you say, Keith, unlikely to be decided before an upcoming general election, but potentially after. Do you think on locational pricing or zonal, let's say, we've narrowed the conversation, is this a helpful thing to provide locational incentives and help to sort out that grid queue and decisions on where to build projects? Or would you put this in the box of interesting academic idea, which ignores the risks it introduces? Maybe if I can put that provocatively.
You're clearly trying to get me to say what I said at a forum very, very recently in your company, where I insulted lots of economists in a room. But I will repeat it for for good purpose, okay? What I said was, if you're an economist and you're sitting in a darkened room, this looks like a bloody good idea. Okay, right. Strip away headline-grabbing nonsense of that statement. But yeah, economically, it looks incredibly sensible. Okay, why wouldn't you, and why wouldn't you move to some kind of system where you give those kind of locational signals? Now, we have a system where there are some locational signals and then the use of system charges on the transmission system. Okay, but do you make those signals much stronger and more specific? The issue or the potential concern, challenge around locational signals is how do you do it and when do you do it? Okay, and when I'm having a conversation with whether it's a regulator, a system operator, or a politician, is to make sure they understand it in the context of we as a country have in effect announced a 60 billion investment program in the grid, and we've drawn the lines on maps and decided where we want to put them. We have a very, very ambitious renewables target in terms of offshore wind and also onshore stuff. Okay. When you're looking to put that much change onto your physical system, do you really, really want to play about with your commercial planning, which is what locational pricing will do in terms of setting directions? And how do you do it in a way that doesn't scare the bejesus out of an investor? Okay. And it was interesting, kind of anecdotally. The last time a press release came out about this a few weeks ago, which was the kicking off stage two of REMA. Yeah. The phone the, there were phones ringing all around the country from analysts going, "What in God's name does this mean? Does this affect? What does this do to a CFD?" Okay, that's exactly the reaction we do not want. So you need to be really, really careful planning and mapping this out. Okay, because if you're bluntly speaking, if you're sitting as a company looking at building an offshore wind farm and aiming for it to be operational in 2030, you kind of need to know what's the trading system and the economic situation, and how do I manage and plan it out, and how do I know it's going to make economic sense? And how do I convince my investors that this is a good, solid prospect? If you're planning and mapping out all of these grid lines, you kind of need to know you're going to go ahead with it. Whereas if you, at the same time as doing that, introduce locational pricing and look at locational pricing from the point of view of wanting to manage and change constraint payments and the economics around constraints, all of a sudden you could find yourself cancelling or changing fundamentally what grid lines you want to plan and build out as well. So doing this in what by any stretch of the imagination is the biggest rewiring of the country, and by any stretch of the imagination from a renewables point of view, one of the largest infrastructure investment projects ever in this country. I just question, is that a good time to introduce locational pricing? I don't doubt the value of locational pricing. I don't doubt the common sense of locational pricing and the economics of it. To me, an awful lot of it is about timing. Okay. Now, but also because we've been what you're like all companies, I've got no doubt they've got people running around looking at all of this and the implications of it or alternatives. And there are other alternatives out there to full-blown locational pricing. So we've put one forward called Optimized Transmission Investment Cost. But what you do is you look at use of system charge, you look at the locational pricing elements, but what you also do is you design it and pitch it to what the future network looks like. So what you're not doing is at the same time interrupting that plan. So you design it, you design a system on the basis of here's what the network's going to look like in 5 years' time. So let's design and implement something in line with that, as opposed to designing and implementing a system now that fundamentally changes the way you look at all of those investments. So There are options around this about moving towards a locational system, but you maybe do it step by step and in a controlled way. And that would be it. Because otherwise, how do I or how does anybody else go to an investor and say, the £5 billion offshore wind project we've got planned for 2032? I don't know if it's going to be a CFD. I don't know what format the CFD is going to take. I don't know if there's going to be a capacity market element to it. I don't know whether the price will change depending on where we build it. Da 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 da. And then, other complexities. Your locational pricing part of it is very much driven about trying to encourage generation investment in certain places. I'm still not too sure how strong that signal is ever going to be for an offshore wind farm when it's the Crown Estate who'd tell you where the zones are. And if I've got a zone off the north coast of Scotland and somebody says, no, the locational signals tell you to build it in the Thames, I might dearly love to move it to the Thames, but I'm not too sure the Crown Estate are going to let me do that. I suppose all I'm trying to get across is that it's a very tricky, difficult concept when there's this amount of change on the system.
No, I think that point is very well made, Keith. And in the analysis Aurora's done around this, probably the single biggest assumption, if we moved it just a bit this way or that way, is the cost of capital. If we assume an increase in the cost of capital, it can very easily wipe out what would otherwise be sort of theoretical societal benefits from such a move. And you are absolutely right that that having any form of locational pricing, but particularly one that's more market driven, like nodal pricing, is introducing some new risks for you as an investor, as an operator, if you're going to build the wind farm and suddenly someone builds one next door, then that will influence the amount of money you make. If a piece of grid infrastructure gets built or does not get built, that influences the amount of money you're going to make. And those are risks that you cannot really control
That's why
yourself.
I say, if you're in a more stable, benign environment, it's a lot easier to do.
And you're right, we don't have, this is not a perfect market where we can move the location of these projects willy-nilly. It's pretty fixed, especially in the offshore wind space. Even in onshore wind, though, is there genuinely that much of a choice? It's pretty much impossible to build an onshore wind project in England. They're pretty much in Scotland.
I do have to keep telling people there's sunshine in Scotland, so building solar north of the border is okay as well. All right. I know you don't believe me, but it's
Locational
true.
pricing could destroy that one, though, Keith, if we're already oversupplied in Scotland. I want to move us on. I mean, we talked actually danced around offshore wind quite a bit. We've talked about grid a lot, but as a major investor, one of the top investors in offshore wind, beyond the kind of grid issue, what do you see as the challenges around offshore wind? We've sort of said there's hugely ambitious targets from the current government. Labour would want to increase them even further. Are these targets in any way deliverable? What beyond the grid issues we've already covered, what are the other barriers kind of holding us back?
So yes, they're deliverable. Okay, you can hit these numbers for offshore wind. I think there are a number of challenges around how you get there and how you do that. Some of which are around specific projects, some of which are around the UK issues, some of which are more global issues. I think the part of the short-term challenge, I think, is, and you could say this is as much the industry's fault as anybody else's, which is I think we got to a point in the UK of convincing everyone, from politicians to regulators to investors to the supply chain. These projects were really, really easy and simple to build and to operate. And we convinced everybody the cost was going to keep coming down. Okay, now I'm not suggesting for a minute anybody ever said the cost will always come down, But that's the kind of mentality that got created around offshore wind. And we saw the price fall from £150 to £100 to £70 to £50 to, and this belief it was going to keep coming down. Well, fool's gold. It couldn't. It was impossible for it to keep coming down at that rate and impossible for it to come down forever. Okay. And when you look at the size and scale of these projects, if you look at the inherent risk around huge, big, complex, highly integrated infrastructure projects, you were headed towards an economic model that just didn't make sense. Now, it hit a big bump in the road. Okay. And that bump in the road, ended up being caused, in effect by changes in the supply chain and economics, where people said, "Whoa, hang on, stop the bus. We can't do that anymore. No one's making money. This doesn't make any sense. This has to change." Now, not unexpectedly, and this isn't just an issue for this country. There was a bit of skepticism and probably amongst regulators and policymakers of, yeah, they've told us that before, but honest to God, let's just keep going. Okay. And it was probably quite important that AR5, in inverted commas, failed. Okay. I would say to you, AR5 didn't fail. I think AR5 has ended up being a huge success because it's brought reality. And a bit of reality back to everybody's view of offshore wind. And that's not a bad thing. It's a good thing. Okay. Where are we now in terms of moving forward? It's about a lot of it now, again, comes back to ambition and plan and strategy around where do you want to go. At one level, the headline numbers for the next auction in the UK, AR6, look quite good. When you scrape behind the numbers, they are more questionable in terms of what will it deliver. Okay. And this comes back to, again, almost what we talked about earlier, where you've got huge, big, high headline, ambitious numbers. But when you start to look down at the closer term granular numbers, do they add up to that ambition? Do they add up to what developers and investors need and want? Do they add up to what the supply chain wants? And I think there's a question mark. Okay. Not for a minute suggesting AR6 will work. It will work. There will be lots of bids. Projects will get built on the back of it. But I sense, and this is again just a UK conundrum, I sense amongst policymakers in lots of countries. There's a okay, but let's not open the floodgates because the price will come back down. Okay. I still think there's a belief this will get cheaper and cheaper and cheaper out there. And people are there's a very a lot of nervousness in countries about, oh my God, will we be seen to massively overpay for the next wave of offshore wind? I think that is highly doubtful. As long as you structure these auctions and structure the system in a way that there is an inverted commas one loser, you will keep competition, you'll keep competitive pressure, that will keep economic reality into people's bidding and the way people behave. But I think that nervousness still exists between the policymakers and the industry about, oh, where's the true equilibrium? Where's the real point? Where's the real cost? It's what we're seeing short term. Okay. The truth is, what we're seeing right now in the market is, at one level, you can look at some statistics and say theoretically the price should be coming back down a bit more because the cost of commodities has come down. But what you're seeing pushing against that are some big supply chain companies who have been losing significant sums of money, saying, "Hang on a minute, I'm not a charity. I need to make money, so the price is staying high." Okay. And you're seeing demand very, very strong still. Worldwide demand for be it turbines, cables, transformers is still incredibly high. So you're seeing that keep pricing pressure in there as well. I And I suppose my challenge to any government policymaker anywhere in the world, if they look at the next 2, 3, 4 years, I'm not sure prices are coming down. Okay. I think there's very little risk for you in being seen to overpay. Therefore, if you've got good value projects that can be built now, why in God's name wouldn't you do that?
Yeah.
And if you're running processes, be it auctions, be it PPAs, be it whatever mechanism you have, where you are falsely capping the amount of stuff that'll come through the process, I'm not too sure that's the best outcome right now. And I think there's a risk that you live to regret it because you fall behind the realism of hitting the big targets.
Yeah, and one factor to add, one factor that's so part of the reason why costs came down so much from the early 2010s until sort of 2020 or around then was cost of capital. It went to a like historically extremely low level and has now bounced back up to what is a much more in inverted commas normal level. People keep on asking, "Oh, when will it go back to that back down to where it was?" It's unlikely to, because that's the historical anomaly. It's not where we are now. It's where we were a few years ago. Yeah, exactly. So I do think I think you're absolutely right, Keith, that we're unlikely to get back to what we did see in allocation rounds 4 and 5 in GB, which was, we're talking prices in the region of £40 a megawatt hour in 2012 money. Let's say that's £50 a megawatt hour roughly now. That's very low for offshore wind, and we're now talking about much, much higher numbers. And I do want to dig into one issue, which I always feel gets limited airtime. So we talked about grid, we've talked about supply chain. There's one, and we talked about planning and permitting. There's one bit of supply chain which I feel gets sort of not much focus, which is actually the human capital, the skills part of this. Are we doing enough to ensure we've got enough fitters, like technical people doing the actual construction of these projects, whether it's the electrical side, the turbine installation itself, working on the vessels? There's so many super complex and technical jobs to do. And yet in the UK, we get a lot of people through university education, but we are actually really bad at training people in more technical and vocational skills.
As you say, it's not talked about as much as a whole lot of the other issues we've discussed, in the energy sector. But you're right. I actually think it's the biggest challenge we have as a country and as a sector. We don't have enough people, and if I use a kind of again sort of anecdotal, oblique, real life example, I'm sat in Glasgow. Our company headquarters in Glasgow. We're looking to recruit another 500, 600 engineers. We have a counterpart, offshore transmission distribution business, who are also looking to recruit 500 or 600 engineers. The energy system operator has just opened a new office in Glasgow, looking to recruit 400 engineers. Right. To my knowledge, there are not 1,500 unemployed engineers kicking about Glasgow. Yeah, so where do they all come from? Now, you as a sector, whether you're in the renewable sector or the network sector, you can probably survive for a couple of years running around stealing staff from each other. But at some point in time, we need to find more of them. Okay. And as a sector and probably as a country, I would say we're not very good at organizing that and developing that. Okay. We can run apprenticeship schemes, which are great. You can look at graduate recruitment schemes, etc. You could start adopting the sort of tactics the oil and gas sector used to use. I don't know if they still do. Where you go in to the universities and you sign the graduates up, and then it's like the old foot, it's like the old football scouting match. You go to the primary school football game and start signing up the best players. You go into the university and you start signing them when they're 2 years away from get your finishing the degree. Again, you know, these things, short term they work, long term they don't. We need a coordinated approach in terms of training academies. We need a coordinated approach in terms of industry-wide apprenticeship programs. And what do I mean by coordinated? We need to get people who are naturally competitors, you need to get them working together on this issue. You need to get this being worked on between the renewable sector and the network sector. And you need to get it being worked on between the energy sector and the supply chain, because we're all looking for these people, okay? And we need to do it in a much, much more coordinated way, where you are setting up things like skills academies to get youngsters out of school and get them trained and qualified in the topics and the areas we need, and push them through and push them out into the workforce as quickly as possible. Okay. If we don't start doing that very, very soon, we're going to find ourselves in a crunch situation where there just aren't enough people. And we'll be sitting here, if we don't do anything about this, we'll be sitting here in 5 or 10 years' time, not talking about the grid queue slowing stuff down. We'll be talking about the lack of people slowing stuff down. Because at the same time, you see the number of financial services companies who are running around recruiting engineers because of the way they think and because of what financial services companies do now. You see this all over the whole economy, people chasing people with the same skills. And we need a better way of getting people through that system much, much faster. That's not having a go at universities, because it's good to have some people coming through the degree route, but we need to have a much better mix of people coming into the system and into the sector as well.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. If ever there was a sort of policy to deal with both with UK's productivity issues, but also the idea of levelling up different regions across the UK, I think this is exactly the one.
The other brilliant thing, which should encourage everybody to do it, is by nature of what we do, it's spread across the whole of the country. If you take you take transmission and distribution businesses, talk about a company that's in every local community. We are. We put wires into everybody's house. So this is something, if you truly want to talk about levelling up, for God's sakes, I don't think there could be a better sector to demonstrate levelling up operating, because you're everywhere.
Yeah, absolutely. I think we've hit on a great topic, but the incoming government, whatever colour it will end up being towards the end of the year, hopefully with your connections into government, Keith, then you can be the one championing the cause here and helping to make this happen. It's been fascinating talking to you, as always. Thanks for your open and honest opinions. So thanks for coming on the podcast.
No, thank you, Richard. So it's great as always.
That was Richard Howard, Aurora's Global Research Director, talking to Keith Anderson, CEO of Scottish Power. Thanks for listening to Energy Unplugged. Do keep an eye on our podcast feed for more in-depth conversations with senior members of the energy industry. The best way to do this is to follow or subscribe to the podcast via whatever platform you use.